Vets reflect on Hiroshima today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Andrew Malone served in Iraq. His relatives fought and died in World War II. So the president's visit to Hiroshima, it's close to home.
It's important just beyond my personal connections because I'm watching the world revert back to historically these acts of barbarism, genocide, and nothing's being done about it. And that's what spawns these bigger events that cost more life.
Also, Kim Jong-un's aunt and uncle disappeared 2 decades ago. Turns out they defected to the U.S.
They run a dry cleaning store. They live in a comfortable but by no means, you know, fancy house. And as the uncle said to me, we have achieved the American dream.
So why does he want to go back to North Korea? Find out today on The World. Glad you could be here this Friday. We begin today with President Obama's historic visit to Hiroshima, first sitting U.S. president to visit this city, devastated by an American atomic bomb 71 years ago. As expected, Obama did not apologize, but in his speech, the president did reflect on the horror that took place that day in 1945.
In the image of a mushroom cloud that rose into these skies, we are most starkly reminded of humanity's core contradiction. How the very spark that marks us as a species, our thoughts, our imagination, our language, our tool making, our ability to set ourselves apart from nature and bend it to our will, those very things also give us the capacity for unmatched destruction.
Obama was also realistic. He noted that evil exists in the world and that the U.S. and its allies need to have the weapons they need to defend themselves. But then, as he has since the start of his presidency, he called for the elimination of nuclear weapons worldwide.
We may not realize this goal in my lifetime, but persistent effort can roll back the possibility of catastrophe. We can chart a course that leads to the destruction of these stockpiles.
Obama's visit to Hiroshima and the one immediately preceding it to Vietnam have powerful historic symbolism. For the millions of Americans who served in Vietnam and the dwindling band of World War II veterans, the visits have special significance. We were curious, too, to see how veterans of more modern wars see the issues. So we pinged our online community of veterans with these questions. What's your reaction to Obama's Vietnam and Hiroshima trip? And how much do World War II and the Vietnam War shape your worldview today? We got plenty of responses and invited two to join us. Andrew Malone, 34, from Miami, served in Iraq as an Army combat medic. And Aaron Dieterding, 38, of Denver, served in Iraq and Afghanistan as an Army helicopter pilot. Both have been on the show before. Welcome to you, Andrew and Aaron. Andrew, I'm going to start with you. President Obama was careful not to apologize for Hiroshima, but nonetheless, several of our vets have criticized him for his apology tour. Where do you land on this one?
I think the criticism is understandable. You know, it came across more of as a constructive apology. He didn't necessarily say the words. If you look at the context of what actually happened in those events during World War II, there were firebombing campaigns that took place weeks prior to the use of the atomic weapons that killed way more people, many more people than the atomic weapons. And Hiroshima was already bombed out. So you have to look at the context of what actually happened. It came across more as an apology and a propaganda soundbite towards this anti-nuclear proliferation. I think it did come across as apology, and I think it was poorly timed and unnecessary. The Japanese don't apologize for the atrocities committed in China or the Bataan Death March or Pearl Harbor, the many things they did every year. We always send a wreath there on Hiroshima Day. And I think it's badly timed considering the fact that we are in a time frame where we're seeing the last of the World War II veterans pass away.
Aaron Dieterding, what about you? I mean, President Obama didn't actually say we're sorry, but do you see this as an apology tour?
I mean, I think, first of all, I think that he was wise and well-advised to not specifically make it an apology. I do think that there was definitely that tone, but I also think that we're at a time when we have to realize that we'll never – you know, most of us will never understand the perspective and the context behind what was going on at that time. And so for that reason, I don't think that it's right or even possible for us to apologize for that. What I do think, though, is that we're in a time of increased globalization, and we need to, you know, kind of move on from our past and look towards the future. And I think, you know, anytime that we can build bonds with other countries, especially ones that we're now friendly with.
Yeah, I guess the, you know, the sense of globalization means that a lot of people do feel that we need to move on. Andrew, you weren't alive when World War II happened. What does it mean to you?
World War II means a lot to me. My one of my great-grandfather, Hugh Gosling, died on D-Day. He was killed in a tank on the beach at Normandy. I have another grandfather who fought under Patton and liberated one of the concentration camps, and we subsequently donated all of his artifacts, pictures, you know, different things to the Holocaust Memorial. I am also from a partly Jewish family, so the Holocaust is something that definitely relates to me. But World War II, I think, even beyond the personal connections that I have to it, this is the war that was supposed to end all wars after the other war that was supposed to end all wars. This was the war that helped spawn the birth of the UN, which started out as a righteous organization committed to specifically stamping out genocide. So I look at the lessons we haven't learned from World War II, the extremism that took place back then and caused everything, and the lack of effort by the free world, you know, waiting too long to get involved to stop it until things got bad. And then you look at the things that are going on right now, and it's important just beyond my personal connections, because I'm watching the world revert back to historically these acts of barbarism, genocide, and nothing's being done about it. And that's what spawns these bigger events that cost more life.
Mm. Aaron, what is your World War II connection, and how does that shape your worldview today?
So similar to Andrew, my grandfather was in World War II. He was retired from the Air Force. He's since passed away. But having that connection, he's someone that from as far back as I can remember was a hero of mine, someone that I looked up to, and someone that was able to reflect on the war and to be constructive about his experience in the war. To me, that really influenced how I see what my perspective is on the world right now. And I think it carries over to this conversation as well, because, you know, I think Andrew made some great points about the stuff that's going on in the world right now. And I think that is even more of a responsibility of a country like the United States, who's a world leader, to find ways to be constructive and to find ways to bring the world together and prevent these kind of things from happening again.
Yeah, speaking of moving forward, I mean, I can imagine in a generation or two, future U.S. presidents visiting Iraq and Afghanistan. Andrew, do you think those kind of visits will have the same kind of symbolism as what we've seen this week with President Obama in Vietnam and Hiroshima?
Well, you know, history plays out in posterity. Posterity takes a while. My bigger concern right now would be what does the landscape of the Middle East look like at that point? Is it the sovereign nations that we know exist today, or is it going to be a caliphate? So that would be it's hard to answer that question without, if things were going to stay the same way and things weren't in such turmoil, then I think some Iraq veterans, Afghanistan veterans might be sour about an apology. We weren't treated as badly, obviously, as Vietnam veterans. And I don't know Aaron's experience with this. My friend had we got back in 2008, my friend's car was spit on us the day we got back. I was physically assaulted and got into an altercation by a college student in a sandwich shop about 2 weeks after getting back. So that animus was still there, the animosity. We still experienced it, but not nearly on the scale as Vietnam veterans. So some people might look at it as an apology. Even during the active war, while I was in the military, when I was home, I had people confront me verbally and say, you know, what do you think you did over there? What was your point of going over there in the first place? And then they get into the whole oil conversation, weapons of mass destruction. And I don't need to go into all the perspectives about that, but there, I think it would be in some areas viewed as a very bad decision by veterans to start apologizing in the Middle East, especially shortly after.
Army veterans Andrew Malone and Aaron Dieterding, thanks very much for reaching out to us with your thoughts.
Thank you, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
Andrew and Aaron are part of our online community of veterans. We often turn to that community to help inform our work here on the world. If you're a vet and want to help, just grab your phone, text the word RETURN to 69866. That's RETURN to 69866. There's an auction scheduled for Monday in Paris, and it's got a lot of people riled up here in the U.S. That's because of what's on the auction block, a collection of Native American sacred objects and artifacts. Such a sale would be illegal in the United States. Native tribal leaders are trying to stop the French auction, but they haven't succeeded so far. We reached out to Bambi Krause to find out more. She's president of the National Association for Tribal Historic Preservation Officers in Washington.
The sale of these important cultural objects goes against our entire way of life and way of thinking about being native in today's global worldview. They're not just art pieces, rather they're cultural objects that were made for a specific culture and were not to be shared with the outside world. Many were stolen from Native communities. Many were sold, as in being sold under duress, because there was a lot of fighting over resources when Western expansion was coming up against Native people in the world. I know from my own personal history as a Tlingit Indian in Southeast Alaska that they were being forced to change their way of life, and they were being starved to death. And they had very little in which they could actually do to preserve their culture, because the burden was being put on them to give away and sign off on their land resources and hunting sites. And it was either eat or, you know, become less of an active member of their culture. So I know that's a long explanation, but these objects have a very long story behind them, each one of them.
Tell us about one of them. I know there's a ceremonial shield that belongs to the Acama Pueblo.
It was important to them as a ceremonial piece and was for their community only. It was made for their use, and it should have no value outside of that community. And that's one of the questions that I've been trying to answer, is what makes these items valuable? So if that's just rawhide and paint, why is that valuable to someone who wants to collect it for its beauty versus what its value is to that community? Not only the shield, but the rawhide shirt with the human hair. There are ceremonial stones that are also being auctioned off. Quite a variety, and it's respective of each individual Native culture. Interestingly, there are even, in addition to these sacred objects, there are human remains that this auction is going to be selling on Monday, including a shrunken head and a foot.
That's extraordinary. I mean,
from 100 years ago.
That's selling human remains.
Yeah. Most of us thought that practice had stopped a long time ago.
It probably would not help a tribe like the Acama Pueblo to buy these items back, but is that a possibility, to buy them back and just take them off the market?
Even if they decide to use some of their, you know, fairly new income that they have, it's not a sustainable practice. I think the bigger goal would be to educate the collectors, and I think that the tribal voice is what people are hearing more and more in the past several years, and that's encouraging because for, you know, many years, we have been seen as a vanished or conquered people, and yet they're living cultures, and the objects such as the Pueblo shield is a living item, and we're trying to reunite these communities again.
Bambi Krause, what would give you satisfaction at this point, having all of these ceremonial pieces returned to the United States, to their rightful tribes?
Well, there's the short-term goal on Monday to at least stop some of these objects. And, you know, some tribes have been contacting me saying that, you know, there are other objects in it that haven't even been discussed that are important to my community. So just starting a dialogue in terms of getting some of these objects off the market immediately, and then a longer experience, it changes the behavior of how people look at these objects and how Native cultures living today are, you know, unique and are truly an American story that nobody else has. And I just wish that there was more understanding of, you know, where we're coming from and our experience.
Bambi Krause, president of the National Association for Tribal Historic Preservation Officers, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate your work.
You're with the world. We reported recently on the closing of the Idomeni refugee camp on the Greece-Macedonia border. Greek authorities bulldozed the makeshift camp and sent residents to stay in more permanent refugee centers. The Idomeni camp had sprung up spontaneously on top of a train station after the nearby border crossing was closed. And life there was difficult, even dangerous, for the 8,000 residents. But many preferred to stay because they enjoyed a certain degree of independence. Reporter Gene Carsonson has a story of one refugee who made his temporary home at the camp.
I caught up with Mahmoud Nakark underneath a train car where he'd set up a bread baking business. He's a law student from Aleppo.
So tell me about what you're doing now underneath the train. You're making, what kind of bread are you making here?
You bread Syria.
Mahmoud sits cross-legged on the tracks covered in flour. I watch as he forms balls of dough and rolls them out very thin on a chunk of wood using a section of pipe. His young assistant, Abdul Rahman, cooks each piece on a battered metal pan over an open fire.
How much bread does he make every day?
300.
5 pieces, €1.
He hands a hot piece of flatbread to me and one to my translator, Wissam. Mahmoud shrugs an apology that he has to serve it to us plain.
What would you eat it with normally?
Here, sometimes they eat it alone, but every good food, that's heavy food.
And do people like his bread?
Yes, sure, because I like it because this is Syrian and I smell Syria in this bread.
Mahmoud arrived in Greece by boat 2 months ago after fleeing the war in Aleppo with his family. After the Macedonia border closed, they were stuck. Wissam is a refugee from Palmyra, and she and Mahmoud talk about their discomfort with having to take handouts in the camp.
It's really hard for us to wait, to stand and take the food from person because we don't take anything from anyone.
Mahmoud says he learned to make bread working in a pizza place in Aleppo while going to law school. But he has other talents as well.
He can read you as a person. We call that read your star.
With the coffee or just by looking at me?
Just to look at you. He can do this. Yes. You want that?
Sure.
He said you are from the kind you like yourself. And
the law student and baker from Aleppo stares into my eyes and then into Wissam's. He tells me I am the sort of person who likes myself outside and inside, which, on a good day, is true. And he tells her she has a big purpose in life and loves someone far away. Then I ask him if he can see the future of Edomeni.
He said they want to pressure on people here to go to clear this camp because...
His prediction was right on. Just a few days later, after a massive police action in Edomeni, the camp was shut down. I don't know where Mahmoud is now, whether he and his family moved to an official camp or maybe tried to cross into Macedonia. But his spot under the freight car in Edomeni, where he baked bread, is empty.
Does he think his family will make it to Germany or Sweden?
We are people don't give up. If we want to give up, we will do that in Syria. We will not go out. So we will. And he said, if anyone have a goal, he will reach it someday.
For the World, Jean Carstensen, Edomeni, Greece.
Jean is reporting in Greece with help from the Pulitzer Center on crisis reporting. She's also working with photographer Jody Hilton. We have some of her pictures up on our Tumblr. They'll give you a sense of what the Edomeni camp used to be like and what's left there now. You can see for yourself at pritheworld.tumblr.com. Another place in Greece that's been a focus for this migrant crisis is the island of Lesbos. More than 1 million migrants and refugees landed there last year alone, and many people in Lesbos welcomed them generously. But that generosity may have come at a cost. You see, tourism is a big industry on Lesbos, and summer bookings for this year are down by 70%. Reporters Daniela Cheslow and Daniel Estrin went to Lesbos for the New York Times travel section recently, and Daniel says they did it for a simple reason. They were curious.
First of all, we report out of Jerusalem, Daniela Cheslow and I. We wanted to meet some of the people fleeing wars almost on our doorstep. And we also had a personal interest because we both descend from Eastern European immigrants. Just like these migrants, they also crossed the sea looking for a better life only in America. And we had read that Lesbos has some of the world's best ouzo. So we wanted to design a trip that could look at both sides of Lesbos, and we did. We experienced Lesbos as this gorgeous Greek island vacation and as the epicenter of this massive, dramatic human migration.
I mean, the Greek island vacation is, I think, something a lot of people can imagine, but as far as vacationing next to people who are escaping war, I mean, was that challenging to your own values? Did it feel callous?
The answer is no. First of all, because when we were there, we were leaving just at as the situation on Lesbos changed. And now, because of a new controversial deal between the EU and Turkey, migrant arrivals have dropped dramatically, and there are very few boats arriving today. If you go looking for it, you will find, you know, testaments to earlier dramas like a graveyard of discarded life jackets or a real graveyard of migrants who drowned on the way. But today, if you're on the beach, you'll hardly see boats coming at all. And this is the best way to help Lesbos, is to come and take a pleasure trip there, because you're going to help Lesbos recover. They have lost a tremendous amount of income because of tourists who think that Lesbos is a crisis, and it's a mistake.
I don't know. It just still feels kind of weird to me, this disconnect. What do the locals on Lesbos think about it?
Well, the locals say this is really what they need, and there's no reason for a tourist to think, well, maybe I shouldn't take my Greek island vacation on Lesbos when all those migrants are there and they're dealing with this. It just doesn't seem right. No, they say, first of all, the situation is completely changed now. There are very few boat arrivals. If you don't go looking for it, you probably won't even realize that there have ever been any migrants on that island today. But locals say, come see Lesbos as it always has been, this beautiful island. It's a kind of a sanctuary of Greek rhythms, this kind of traditional Greek life. You know, it's a place where sheep and cars share the roads. It's just a beautiful, beautiful place, and made even more beautiful, I think, because of the bottomless generosity that the locals extended toward these newcomers.
You and Danielle are right that avoiding Lesbos would be a mistake. You sincerely feel that, huh?
I really do. I mean, it has, first of all, some of the world's best ouzo and sardines. So, I mean, what are you waiting for? It's a 45-minute flight from Athens. The people are lovely.
Daniel Estrin telling us about the tourism possibilities on the Greek island of Lesbos. Daniel, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Okonomiyaki. If you're not from Hiroshima, it's a dish that can be hard to swallow.
You know, the Japanese have an expression, meide taberu, we eat with our eyes. And I don't eat with my eyes, I close my eyes when I eat okonomiyaki because it's kind of a mess.
But the taste might change your mind. That story's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. President Obama was in Hiroshima today for a historic visit to that city, obliterated by an American atomic bomb 71 years ago. He talked about eliminating nuclear weapons and about peace. That made us think about last summer when huge protests rocked Japan over government plans to increase the power of the Japanese military. Now, that kind of demonstration would be news anywhere, but especially so in Japan. People just don't protest there. Here's more on that from reporter Naomi Gingold.
When Aki Okada was 14, he ran away from home. Okada ran away and stayed away.
I went and lived on Yayamasho, the southernmost island in Japan. I mean, there are Japanese who don't even know it, because there are only 50 people who live there.
He'd been bullied in school, so he just stopped going. And his home life was also unusual. His father was a Christian priest, and his parents took in the homeless. And he says,
the whole let's help people thing at home was so completely different from the atmosphere at school. I didn't know who I was supposed to be.
And he laughs and says, you know, I was an adolescent. Okada later went on to an unusual boarding school in the countryside, where students got to vote on the rules. And then, just as he was about to start college, the earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear meltdown hit Japan. It was 2011. Okada started going to the anti-nuclear protests. He says the triple disaster was a turning point. For starters, there was the lack of believable information from the government about what was going on. Then Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's right-leaning government announced they were restarting nuclear reactors. Then they announced a new state secrets law, clamping down on journalists.
It
felt like the government had gone too far, and things were just so out of balance, I felt I had to do something to stop it.
Now, normally in Japan, most people don't talk about politics, not with friends or family, and the idea of college students as politically active or socially engaged... In Japan, it's the opposite. College is known as your last chance to party. Being into politics, not so cool. Okada also says,
It's really hard to speak out in Japanese society. There is this idea that people don't think about politics, that young people are apathetic.
But even though people may not be speaking up,
there are people who are thinking about politics. People like SEALDS.
SEALDS, Students Emergency Action for a Liberal Democracy, his group. Okuda, at 23, is now the frontman of what's become one of the largest activist movements ever in Japan. When Abe introduced legislation last year to expand the power of the military and change Japan's pacifist constitution, SEALDS started organizing weekly protests in front of parliament. Most people opposed Abe's security bill, but in Japan, protests have an image problem. In the 60s and 70s, there were big student demonstrations that turned violent. People even died. And that image of protesters as violent extremists has stuck. So Okada and SEALDS knew that they needed to change the culture around protests and make it seem like any regular person could and should join. They started holding educational events. They produced these slick, eye-catching ads and brochures featuring themselves, stylish, regular college students. At first, protests were small. But by mid-July and August, they hit 60,000, then 120,000 people. And they attracted prominent academics and politicians. SEALDS groups popped up all over Japan. And then groups inspired by SEALDS. Eventually, Okada was invited to speak in parliament. But in the end, the prime minister rammed the military bill through. And SEALDS turned their attention to this summer's election. Recently, they helped bring opposition parties together. And they've been doing big get-out-the-vote campaigns. Still, one of the main criticisms of SEALDS is that they're not serious enough, that they're focused on style over substance.
I
mean, the fact that people would say that means we changed the image of protests.
Okada says his larger goal has always been to create a culture where it's okay for anyone to just say their opinion and talk about politics. Create a new normal. However July's election goes, it's clear something is changing in Japan. And a group thought of as the most disconnected is leading the way. For The World, I'm Naomi Gingold.
Our next story is about a dish that's informally known as the Japanese pancake, actual name okonomiyaki. But it's unlike any pancake you've ever had before. It has cabbage, egg, fish flakes, scallions, sometimes pork. In Hiroshima, where President Obama visited today, okonomiyaki is very popular. They use noodles as the base there. Then it's topped with a type of Worcestershire sauce and Japanese mayonnaise. The World's Jason Margolis has more.
I was in Japan 14 years ago when a friend from Hiroshima wanted to introduce me to a beloved local food. It had a funny name, a funny taste, and a funny appearance. It wasn't for me. Mary White, an expert on Japanese culture with Boston University, had a similar experience.
I didn't like it the first time I had it. It's a very goopy dish. It doesn't look pretty. You know, the Japanese have an expression, meidei taberu, we eat with our eyes. And I don't eat with my eyes. I close my eyes when I eat okonomiyaki because it's kind of a mess.
And okonomiyaki moves right before your eyes.
What it has on top are bits of shaved bonito, dried bonito flakes, fish flakes, which are dancing because of the heat of the egg mixture that has been cooked. So you've got this visual thing going on.
If you just can't imagine this dance, we've got a video of it at PRI.org. Okonomiyaki means as you like it. The Japanese people throw anything and everything in there. White says she even tried it with uncooked oysters on top. She says it was slimy, which can actually be a positive with Japanese food. but a tough sell for a Westerner. The dish is centuries old, but became popular in Japan after a devastating earthquake in 1923, then after World War II.
Food was short. Cabbages were brought in because cabbage is a very cheap, easily grown extender food. People had to be very flexible about what they ate. If they could get eggs, they could have okonomiyaki. So anything went with it.
I gave okonomiyaki a second try. I bought some from a street vendor in Tokyo. It's often a street food in Japan. And something clicked. Not only did I like it, I became somewhat obsessed with it. I craved it. I sought it out. Mary White had a similar transformation, but I've only found it once in the United States, at a hole in the wall in San Francisco. Then recently, I was out to dinner in Boston near Fenway Park at a hip new restaurant called Hojoko, and there it was.
And you'll notice that with okonomiyaki, it's essentially vegetables that are held together by a pancake batter.
That's executive chef Hart Lowry. He adds mountain yam and bacon to his okonomiyaki to make it unique and more palatable for Americans. Whatever he's doing, it's working. It's phenomenal. It's partly the place. He explains that Hojoko isn't like most Japanese restaurants Americans know. It's an izakaya, an informal Japanese tavern where small plates are served tapas style.
It's a place where people go to have fun with their friends and relax and get weird. The music's loud, the food is loud, the drinks are loud. In most restaurants, alcohol supports the meal. We're kind of the reverse of that.
Back in Japan, okonomiyaki is a drinking food. Lowry says here it's also a fun way to push people out of their comfort zones with Japanese cuisine. I asked why more Japanese restaurants in the U.S. aren't offering it.
Yeah, I don't know why it's not popular. It should be.
Mary White at Boston University says today could be a big chance for the dish to catch on and go international.
Perhaps if President Obama were to taste okonomiyaki in Hiroshima, it might become a trend food. I think it could be a wonderful street food here.
There are perhaps 2,000 places serving okonomiyaki in Hiroshima. So far, no reports of the president trying any. For The World, Jason Margolis, Boston.
Talking openly about politics in North Korea is not normal there, and two people in particular know why. Ko Young-suk is the aunt of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Her husband is Ri Gang. Now, here's the thing. According to the Washington Post, in an extraordinary bit of reporting, they defected to the United States and have been living here for the past 18 years with their children. Reporter Anna Fifield met the couple and wrote the story for the Post, but under one condition, she cannot reveal where they live. Pretty amazing tale, Anna. How'd you find them?
It is like amazing that they have now come out of the woodwork. They have been living anonymously for almost 20 years in the U.S. But at the end of last year, they started to sue some defectors in South Korea for defamation. These defectors were high ranking and were appearing on South Korean TV saying all sorts of things about this couple, saying that they had stolen money from the regime, that they'd told the CIA where the Kim family kept all its slush funds, and that had plastic surgery to hide their identities and all this kind of stuff. So
any of that true?
Definitely not the last one, I can tell you that, because it really struck me when Kim Jong-un's aunt walked into the place where we were meeting them. She looked just like her sister, wow. Kim Jong-un's mother, and looked a lot like the earlier version of herself that we'd seen photos of. Mm. So they say now that the husband, Ri Gang, wants to return to North Korea on a visit. And the first step towards doing that was putting right some of the lies, as they put it, that have been spread about them.
I mean, given that they defected, isn't Ri concerned that he might be the target of some kind of reprisal if he goes back?
Yeah, you'd think so. I mean, there's a lot of people who've disappeared or been executed in North Korea for much lesser things than this.
Did you have to persuade them to talk, or were they ready?
They were ready. We talked to their lawyer in South Korea who'd been pursuing the defamation case for them, and he was the intermediary for this. But, you know, of course, we were anxious leading up to the interview whether they were really going to show up. But they did, and we spent all day Saturday, all day Sunday together with them, having, you know, lots of meals together. We drove home with them in their car to their house where they live. And, so we spent a lot of time with them and managed to build some rapport with them.
So the husband, Ri Gang, wants to go back to North Korea on a visit. Do we know how they're perceived back home in Pyongyang?
We don't know from the North Korean side, but we can take a pretty educated guess that the answer would be not well. These were, members of the royal family of North Korea who defected, you know, into the arms of the imperialist Americans, as they're called in North Korea. So I think that that would be considered treasonous by North Korea today. And there's really no reason for them to allow them to go back. So I think it's highly unlikely. But the reason that Ri Gung, the uncle, gave to me was that he said he wanted to go back and act as a kind of bridge between the U.S. and North Korea and help repair relations. And he also said that he's learned a lot about capitalism during his almost 2 decades in the U.S. and years before that in Europe. So he said he thought that he could, you know, teach North Korea a thing or two.
Interesting to know how much Kim Jong-un really wants capitalism lessons from Ri Gung. How does the couple regard Kim Jong-un, their nephew, and his regime?
They were quite frank about his childhood, and they told me about what a troublemaker he was, or like how opinionated he was. He clearly had a very privileged upbringing, and they talked freely about that. But even now, when we were talking to them, they would call him Marshal Kim Jong-un. They would use his proper title in Korean. They would not criticize him or the regime. The husband, Ri Gung in particular, was talking about the need for North Korea to have nuclear weapons. So clearly, Mr. Ri in particular is very sympathetic to the regime, and they were, you know, they're trying to get back into Kim Jong-un's good books. So they were careful about what they said publicly.
I mean, Auntie Ko knew young Kim Jong-un intimately. She changed his diapers. Did she talk about what he was like as a kid?
She said that her son was born the same year that Kim Jong-un was. So they were playmates from birth, basically. So they spent a lot of time in Pyongyang together. And then she was his guardian for several years in Switzerland, where Kim Jong-un went to school.
They had a lot to lose by defecting, since they were part of the North Korean elite. What did they tell you about their lives in North Korea's tiny upper class?
Well, they talked about times when they'd been drinking cognac and eating caviar with Kim Jong-il. The aunt talked about Kim Jong-il driving her around Pyongyang in his Mercedes-Benz. So they had this very privileged life there. And also in Switzerland, they clearly had access to money while they're in Switzerland. And they showed me photos of their children and the Kim children, you know, skiing in Switzerland and eating at restaurants in Italy and like living the good life in Europe.
Why would they leave North Korea then?
They said that it was because Kim Jong-un's mother, the Ko Yong-suk's sister, was sick with breast cancer, which is true. She had terminal breast cancer, and that the medical treatment she'd received in Europe hadn't worked. So they said that they wanted to come to the U.S. and try and find a doctor there to treat her. They also hinted, and this has been speculated before, that they were worried about losing their position within the North Korean regime. So I think that they did not want to run afoul of the regime and saw an opportunity to leave and did.
So what's their life like now in the U.S.? I doubt they're drinking cognac and eating a lot of caviar.
They are not. They live a very ordinary, anonymous life. They run a dry cleaning store. They live in a comfortable, but by no means, you know, fancy house. They have 3 children who are grown now and live normal professional lives in the United States. And as Ri Gung, the uncle, said to me, we have achieved the American dream.
Incredible story. Anna Fifield of The Washington Post in Tokyo. Thanks for telling it to us.
Great. Thanks, Marco.
You are with The World. On this historic day in Japan, with President Obama's visit to Hiroshima, we end the show with a different chapter of Japanese history. The Ainu are an indigenous group in Japan. Historians believe their ancestors were among the first to arrive there. Today, at least 25,000 Ainu live in Japan, but with very few exceptions, they no longer speak the language of their ancestors. Our podcast, The World in Words this week, explores the Ainu language with the help of a Russian linguist who's taught herself Ainu. Here's Patrick Cox with an excerpt from the podcast.
Anna Bugeva knew from an early age she'd be a linguist, just like her mom.
I guess even before going to elementary school, I would be reading all these languages written in Cyrillic, was scattered all over in our flat.
And that flat, that apartment in St. Petersburg, Russia, it was full of books and full of people from far away who spoke foreign tongues, Korean, Manchu,
Kazakh, Kyrgyz, Uzbek. So quite early I was exposed to really linguistic diversity, and I never felt scared in front of other people. And we had happened to have this dictionary of Ainu dialects. Of course, we had many books in Chinese and Korean. They had the dictionary of Ainu dialects, and of course, I started reading it.
And so Anna wound up in Japan studying Ainu. She made a beeline for the University of Hokkaido. Hokkaido is the northernmost of Japan's main islands. It's considered the Ainu's homeland, though actually they settle in other parts of Japan too. But it's where most Ainu live, where some of them hunt and fish as they used to. Anna knew who she wanted as her teacher, one of a handful of Japanese linguists who studied Ainu.
And he just got his job at this time. He was just 35 and I was his first student ever, I guess. And I don't think he has ever met a foreigner at all that close. And he kind of hesitated, but he would say, okay. I could barely speak Japanese, of course. I got accepted, you know, got into the club.
Ainu is a language isolate. It has no linguistic relatives. Nobody knows where it came from or where the Ainu people came from. There are just theories and clues embedded in the language. The professor had taught himself Ainu. Anna, his student, did the same. Except that Ainu is barely a living language. People say there are 10 or so native speakers left. But even that's an exaggeration. True native speakers, people who actually speak Ainu as their first language, as their default, that number, it may be zero. Anna says that since the 1950s, Ainu hasn't really been a spoken language at all, so you have to learn it by reading texts and listening to scratchy old recordings. And if you're lucky, you find some really, really old people who still speak a bit of the language and you get them talking. Even then, what they're passing on isn't exactly, how are you? Not bad. Can you help fix my iPhone? I can't access my emails. No, you're going to get recollections from childhood, maybe simple discussions with their grandparents, or more likely, folk tales that they learned by heart as kids, stories and epic poems.
They would be able to recite quite long stories, like 30 minutes. Some would last for even 2 hours or whatever. Well, I've had such a speaker who I recorded with her 15 stories, folk tales. The longest is probably 40 minutes. Yes, but she was one of the last really fluent speakers.
The woman's name was Ito Oda. This is a recording Anna made in 1998. Oda is reciting an epic about the Ainu thunder god.
I don't know how is it possible. And can you imagine a person who is already 90 years old? Already, half of the time I would go to the hospital to work with him.
In this session at the hospital, they use more conversational language. But it's not a real conversation. That barely exists in Ainu anymore. The words have been scripted by Anna ahead of time. She asks Ito Oda to express the different ways in Ainu to say, Anna and Ito exchanged earrings with each other.
But still she was so happy about transmitting the language. Like her own children or grandchildren wouldn't bother about it often, but there was some person from overseas coming to record it. And she would be coughing, but making an effort to really transmit the language. And sometimes people, I don't know if they've spoken it at all normally, but they would remember these folk tales.
Because some grandparent had recited it endlessly to them when they were a child, absolutely, even if they didn't understand other aspects of the language.
I think it was like that. It was their lifestyle. So they would gather somehow in the evening. She described it to me. People in the villages especially, they usually visit each other quite often. And what they would be doing is reciting this folklore. It was still part of their culture. And you know, some of the stories are even for gods, to please the gods. Some are to amuse each other. And they would really believe that these are all true stories. It was their way of their lifestyle, basically. Probably their joy after hard work. That's the only possible way I think she could have learned it.
That's linguist Anna Bugeva, and the world's Patrick Cox of The World in Words is here. Patrick, when you reported this story in Japan, did you meet any Ainu speakers yourself?
Yeah, I did. Anna introduced me to several Ainu and people who are married to Ainu who are trying to sort of relearn the language. And in one case, the husband of an Ainu, he is the language expert of the family. Even though he's originally from the other end of Japan, he now teaches Ainu conversation classes to young Ainu, and he and his wife are also trying to raise their daughter bilingually in Japanese and Ainu. So he has very much embraced this language that he didn't grow up with.
Never too late to learn. Thanks, Patrick.
You're welcome, Marco.
That's The World's Patrick Cox, and you can listen to The World in Words podcast via iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And next month, The World in Words will be recording a live podcast at the New York Public Library. It's called From Ainu to Zaza. It's on June 21st. We have details at pri.org/language. And that's all from us this Friday. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. I'm Marco Werman, coming to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Have a great holiday weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.